Services and Women's Wellness. I open a work session on House Bill 2191. John? Okay, Tricia Baxter from the Department of Human Resources.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. We were able to work with the Oregon Law Center on Friday afternoon to come up with some language to propose an amendment to House Bill 2191. Specifically, in Section 1, Paragraph 2, there was a concern that the language was awfully broad. So I would draw your attention to that paragraph. And what we have agreed upon is to change that to read, spent lawfully received public assistance that is designated for a specific purpose on an expense not approved by the Department of Human Services. So inserting the words that is designated for a specific purpose. The concern of the Oregon Law Center was the way that this paragraph read before. It looked like every expense that the client chose to spend funds on, for example, if they receive funds through the TANF grant, anything they spent those funds on could be questioned by the department, and that certainly was not the intent. The intent is that the TANF grant funds be spent on basic requirements for that purpose. So this narrows that language so that the purpose of the funds remains intact, but we're not examining every expense. Oregon Law Center was in favor of that proposal. What we would like to do, however, is ask that the committee go ahead and pass this bill out with an agreement that we would do these amendments on the Senate side. Our understanding is it's taking quite a while right now to get amendments drafted. We've been told they won't come out until March. Right. So we'd like to keep this bill moving, and we do have agreement from the Oregon Law Center that amending these on the Senate side would meet their needs as well.
Great. Thank you so much. Any questions?
And I do have some copies of the language if you'd like those.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, and we would like those. And John Mullen, would you like to come up and talk about your agreement?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. And I just would add that we appreciate the willingness of DHS to work out this language, and we're pleased with the outcome.
Great. Any questions of Mr. Mullen?
Madam Chair, just thank you for working together so quickly. We appreciate that.
Yes, I do. Okay, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2191 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gelser moves House Bill 2191 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? Any further discussion? If not, the assistant will call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative
Kozak?
Aye.
Representative
Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye.
The motion carries, and would you like to carry it on the floor?
Sure.
Representative Gelser? Good. I close the work session on House Bill 2191. I open the work session on House Bill 2184. Is there anyone that we should hear from? Okay. Do you want to remind us what this bill does, 2184?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
House Bill 2184 would amend an Oregon statute so that the deputy director of the department and the principal assistant personnel positions would move into an unclassified status and would serve at the pleasure of the director of the department.
And originally there was a request that this go to Ways and Means because of a fiscal. Since then, we've heard from the co-chair of Ways and Means that it does not have a fiscal, so it will not go to Ways and Means. So, yes, Representative.
Go ahead.
Oh, Madam Chair, do you have a comment?
Sure.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move the committee recommend rescinding the subsequent referral on House Bill 2184 and that we send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kotek moves that the committee recommend rescinding the subsequent referral on House Bill 2184 and that we send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions or comments? All right. So we just have a vote now, right? So will the staff please call the roll?
President Callen?
Aye.
President Gilzer?
Aye.
President Gillian?
Aye.
President
Maurer?
Aye.
President Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. So the House Bill 2184 passes with a unanimous vote, and it was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Kotek will carry it.
Yes, thank you.
Great. So I close the work session on House Bill 2184. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2022. Public hearing. So we'll close the work session on 2022 and open up a public hearing on 2022. Okay. Representative Olson, do you want to talk about this bill? Okay. Andy will first talk about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the benefit of the parties that are in the room and the committee, House Bill 2022 is a measure that would require healthcare employers to adopt prevention measures, planning initiatives, and procedures to help reduce violence against nurses in the workplace. The bill would also require the Department of Consumer and Business Services to work with these employers to help them. The employers will maintain the records, but the Department of Consumer and Business Services would collect those and report back to the legislature. And the measure specifically also requires that creates protections for nursing staff members. It establishes that a nursing staff member can have a second staff member involved if there's a question of violence in the workplace. And also there's the right for the employee to have a communication device that would permit them that would allow them to call for help. The bill itself stems from discussions in the last legislative session under House Bill, Senate Bill 572. There is one amendment that has been proposed. It's Amendment 1. It would amend the bill language on line 12 to clarify the definition of employees. Broadly, to give some context to what is the definition of healthcare employers under the statutes, or under the proposed statute, that would include an ambulatory surgical center and hospitals, and those are both defined in another statute, what those actually mean.
Thank you. I see that Senator Metzger is here to testify. Do you want to testify first, or should we have Brian DeLashmet go first?
Well, I start, and then let Brian go to the details.
Okay. Yes.
May I?
Yes. Sure. Representative Olson chaired the committee that proposed this bill and had hearings during the interim.
There you go. Oh, nobody's making fun of me with that back there.
No, I don't think so. Shall we start with Representative Olson first?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Andy Olson. I'm a state representative from the Albany area and happen to be a member of your committee here. But as you're aware, House Bill 2022, dubbed the Health Care Employees Protection Bill, is a product of an interim task force from last year that I chaired. I greatly appreciate the members who worked with me on this, and that included Representative Bill Girard, Phil Barnhart, John Lem, and, of course, Madam Chair. This bill has come a long ways from its beginning last session as Senate Bill 572 with Senator Rick Metzger and I working together on that from opposite ends of the building. Initially, the bill applied only to nurses and was much broader in scope than what you have in front of you today. Numerous hours have been devoted toward the interim in developing this bill. I visited three hospitals personally myself, Sacred Heart Hospital down in Eugene, Samaritan Albany General, down in Albany, and then Providence up in Portland. I know that most of the task force members did visit hospitals in their respective areas. I greatly appreciate the kindness and the hospitality of the staff members from each of the hospitals as I went through them and visited them. It was a great opportunity to learn about what each of them were doing to combat violence in the workplace. House Bill 2022 has several components that impact hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers, also ASCs, as I'll refer to them. And I just want to take the moment to share the 6 points of what this bill does do. It directs a healthcare employer to identify existing or potential hazards for healthcare employees. It requires management to develop and implement assault prevention and protection programs. It requires management to provide protection and awareness training to specific employees. It directs management to keep records of assaults involving employees. It creates an avenue for employees to refuse treatment of a patient that has a history of assaultive behavior unless accompanied by a second person or backup. It creates a retaliatory action protection of the employee by management should the employee refuse to treat a patient with assaultive history. And I could go through all the sections with you one by one, but I think that, you know, you can read that, and it's pretty self-explanatory, and there'll be others, too, as well, that can share some of those things. I greatly appreciate all those that have been involved, because there's been an extreme amount of work involved, especially during the interim time with this, to find some common ground to make this be really good. The major turning point for me occurred back in June last year, where we had a work group session for a couple hours, and all the stakeholders were invited to attend, and we were able to accomplish a lot of things, and I greatly appreciate all those that were involved with that. So just in closing, I really do believe this bill brings some consistency for protection and prevention for healthcare employees throughout the state.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative Olson. All right, thank you. Senator Rick Metzger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. First of all, I'm going to declare a potential conflict of interest because my company works for healthcare employers who would be impacted by this bill. Having said that, I want to reiterate what Representative Olson said. A lot of work has gone into this process. As he mentioned, we started with Senate Bill 572 last year, where Representative Olson and I were the chief sponsors. This was in my committee, in my business committee, and despite the fact that it was a chief sponsor and it was in my committee, this was the very last bill that my committee passed out prior to the closing of the committee in the 2005 session. And what that means is because we worked very, very hard on trying to get through to the issues and provide a result that was positive for workers, healthcare workers in the state. That work continued in the interim as Representative Olson with his leadership and yours, Madam Chair, to really perfect some of those questions that still remained. I would only say that, we're very anxious to get this back in my committee on the Senate side with all the great work that has been done. It did pass overwhelmingly in the Oregon Senate last year. Unfortunately, did not have an opportunity for a work session in the House last year. But I think those dynamics have changed, and I think everyone who has worked very, very hard on this bill understands how important it is to not only provide safety for our healthcare workers, but also be able to document and to have programs in place that will help reduce violence in the workplace. With that, I commend all of you for your hard work on this and hope for an expeditious movement through the House so that we can finish your good work in the Senate.
Great. Thank you, Senator Metzger. Any questions, Senator? Thank you both very much. Next, I will call up Brian DeLashmut and Bob Clements and Penny Cullen.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian DeLashmut. I'm the longtime lobbyist with the Oregon Nurses Association. In my 28 years representing ONA, there's been very seldom in which I've had a bill other than a workers' comp bill that has taken as long and as many sets of amendments as this bill. Just to demonstrate that, as Representative Olson and Senator Metzger indicated to you, it went through a lot of transitions last session, and then during the interim had additional transitions. This is just one of two files on this bill. There were at least 19 sets of amendments on the Senate side before it got to the House. And quite frankly, we ran out of time toward the end. Committees were closing down. I will not try and blow smoke. There are still opponents. There were opponents then. But the momentum was there. The bill clearly passed the Senate with an overwhelming vote and had sufficient support on the House side to get it through. It just ran out of time. Let me take you through a little bit more of the history, and then I'll have the two nurses that are with me today tell their personal stories. We had a number of folks that came in last session and during the interim that had their own personal stories to tell about workplace violence, including when the legislators went down and visited the individual hospitals or facilities and were given a taste of what we were really talking about. But let me talk to you a little bit about what's gone, because this bill really, after the transition, is probably only about 70% of the original bill. There are a number of things that are gone, and you need to understand the transition that went into this bill to know where we are today and how much work has been done. First thing that I would mention is that in the original bill and the first number of iterations of that bill, there were penalties on healthcare facilities. You'll see in this bill there are no longer any penalties for these healthcare facilities for violations of these. We take in good faith the commitment by these facilities to do what we believe is the right thing to do without having to have a hammer over the top of their head. We heard that last session and decided we'll play nice and we'll do the right thing, and we believe they'll do the right thing if the bill passes. Second major piece was in who actually collects the data, where the reports go to. And there was some, I think, concern about this process really being in a parallel process where you had a BOLI process dealing with workplace safety and so forth and time loss and injuries. And then you had a second, which the original bill had, process of gathering data through the OSP and their criminal reporting system. We heard that concern about the two parallel tracks, and with the direction of the chair during the interim, Representative Olson, we decided that there was some validity to having just the one track. And so this bill no longer has the direct collection of data through the criminal justice system and through OSP and their database. It goes through the other system. You will hear, and you may have already heard, from folks who say there really isn't a problem. And believe me, those legislators that went out to the facilities did hear there was a problem. I hear there's a problem. Every time I sit down in a meeting, I hear nurses tell their individual stories. And so there, in fact, is a problem. If there weren't a problem, we wouldn't have the bill. And I don't want to portray to anyone on here that there's a problem everywhere. I think one of the really very nice features of this bill, it really focuses on data collection, so we know where there is a problem and where there needs to be some corrective action. But I don't want to paint this picture that there is this huge, enormous problem out there in every single facility. That's not the case. The other thing that I will point you to is this document here, and it was put together by me. And I won't spend a lot of time on it. I'll let the nurses tell their story. But going into the interim, this document was originated by me to kind of show what were the issues of still that we had concern about that we were trying to accomplish during the interim. And the Tier 1 items were, of course, the very highest issues for us. Data collection. I mentioned about data collection, and that's now been moved to BOLI. Rights to report. We had concerns that if a nurse, in fact, or any healthcare worker was criminally assaulted in a facility, was there some protections that that nurse, if they went external, they called the police and the police came and investigated, there was some protections of that employee in the workplace. We've been told that that, in fact, is covered in other BOLI statutes, and we didn't need to have that in this bill. And again, taking away that criminal justice element of this bill and focusing on the data collection and the corrective action. Patient confidentiality, of course, was an issue that we needed to work through. What information does a healthcare employee have that enables them to make some determination that there's potential for violence, and then what information is released outside in the criminal investigations and so forth. We tried to attempt to work through that, and I think we made a very valiant effort. But the ability for a nurse to report externally and have that communication internally is, in fact, covered in BOLI again. So we left virtually a whole variety of pages out of that bill. Hospital policies and safeguards for nurses. That's probably, besides the data collection, the largest component of this bill. It really is. As you see, as you go through the bill, there are requirements to have training and annual visitations of the training, have the systems and process that would assist not only the facility but also the individual healthcare workers in knowing how to react to the situations, how you can de-escalate those kinds of situations. So that was very important to us. The second staff to visit violent patients is an important component and still in the bill. It's contained in a couple of places. And home health, and you'll hear from one of the nurses in home health today, but home health is a different situation than in a controlled environment in which you have a hospital and you may potentially have security personnel or you have other folks around. In a home health situation, these folks are going out virtually by themselves, many times into very remote areas with no ability to push the panic button and have somebody there within 30 seconds. So there are elements in this bill on the third page dealing specifically with home health and the ability of communication. The Tier 2 issues that we attempted to work through were self-defense and what's the right level of self-defense. If, in fact, you are attacked as a healthcare worker, do you have some ability to defend yourself? And we believe we've come to a balance within this bill after much discussion from a variety of different groups that covers that particular piece. What is the definition of hospital, and is the state hospital included? That was another issue that was kind of up in the air, and by the definition of hospital, yes, the state hospital is, in fact, included. We had a number of people, both last session and during the interim, that were workers from the state hospital, and some very high visibility cases in which the nurses or a healthcare worker over there were beaten within an inch of their life in one particular case, and we wanted to make sure that they have that same protection. Other healthcare settings to be discussed, as it currently is defined, there are really three. There's the hospital setting, the traditional hospital setting, the ambulatory surgical center setting, and the home healthcare setting. There was discussions about who should be in, who should be out. That's what the final work of the interim group got down to, was those three. But that was still being juggled. And then the final thing that was up for discussion during the interim was, what additional healthcare workers? Because this bill in its original form 572 just covered nurses. It was a bill that was introduced by the Oregon Nurses Association for nurses. And as we went through the transition during last session and then the interim, there was concern about, well, why just nurses? If you have other people in these same kinds of settings that are assaulted, why not have them have the protection? So that was an additional thing that was discussed, and the current version does expand it beyond that. And with that, if there's no questions about the actual bill itself and its structure, I guess I would turn it over to the nurses, and they can tell their own individual personal story.
Great, and we definitely want to hear that. But somebody has their phone on, and it's affecting the sound system, so if you could make sure your BlackBerries and your phones are all turned off, please, we'd appreciate that.
Everybody's waiting. This is in their breast pockets.
Introduce yourself for the record. Then.
Okay. For the record, my name is Penny Colin, and I work at a home health hospice agency operated from a hospital in Douglas County. I've been a nurse for 22 years and the last 10 in home health. Our agency covers a huge area, probably one of the largest in the state, and a largely rural area. It's not uncommon for us to travel well over 100 miles in a day, and to some very, very remote areas. And we do carry cell phones, but probably less than 50% of the time do we have coverage for those cell phones. And I was glad to hear that it didn't just cover nurses, because our staff includes physical therapy, occupational therapy, bath aides, social workers, spiritual care that goes out to homes. So it's good to hear that all of those are covered. My personal experience as far as, violence, direct violence, occurred several years ago before we had cell phones, and it was in a home of an elderly lady with severe lung problems, and she lived with her son, who was an alcoholic and usually very docile and easy to work with, and we had instructed him that he was not to smoke in the home due to her respiratory problems. And I'd come one day, she was very short of breath, and he'd been drinking and he was smoking in the home, and I reminded him that, you know, that this was really not good for her, and asked him to go out and finish my visit. When I left to go out, he was sitting at a table in the backyard with his 24 beer cans empty, lined up in front of him, and also with a revolver on the table. And a revolver that wasn't pointed, but laying on the table with his hand over the handle and the trigger, and just pointed at me as I walked to my car. And, you know, not a word was said, and I didn't say a word, and calmly left and went and called the police. And it was in a rural area, and the police did know him, so they didn't think it was a big idea or a big deal in that he was not a threat. There's many instances like this that we face every day, where we're going into homes where there's, you know, alcohol, drugs, lots of firearms, that you see families that are not necessarily functional. And I have other incidences of other nurses facing similar situations. And, you know, the incidences that I'm talking about mostly occur during the day. But we're out there, and we're by ourselves, and we're alone. And I think one of my big concerns, too, is that during the day, you know, we can take another staff member, but if we're going into some of these very rural areas at night, that we not only face the danger of going into somebody's house where at night maybe they've had longer to drink, maybe, you know, if we've called in there, it's something's going on, it's more of an emergency, but we also face the danger of going up rural roads where there's no markings for the house, and going to the wrong house. So, and showing up at 3 o'clock in the morning at the wrong house with no cell phone coverage. So it would be nice, and I would hope that when they say that you take, you know, that you would be able to take someone with you in incidences at night, that if we felt we needed someone to go with us, that person would be a trained security person, not just another nurse or a bath aide, but that somebody that would be trained for security, maybe that worked out of the hospital. As far as how often we go out at night, hospice nurses are in our county mandated to make time of death, so they can make several calls, you know, over many hundreds of miles into very rural areas in the middle of the night. And so not only do you have the family that might have, drug and alcohol issues and be dysfunctional, but now they're in grief, and this nurse is in the home alone, having to deal with that. And I wouldn't say that this happens every day, but it's really frequently that we go into the homes where we find all of those elements, and also including animals, dogs. And I do want to say that I do feel that our employer, if we felt unsafe, we would have the option, you know, of leaving the home immediately. I've heard from nurses that, you know, it wasn't the patient that was causing the violence, but another family member, and they were very torn about leaving the home for their own safety and leaving the patient in jeopardy and their rights and responsibilities about abandoning the patient in that situation. I guess that's all.
Thank you, Ms. Cullen. Mr. Clements.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Robert Clements, Jr. I'm a registered nurse at an emergency department in Portland, Oregon. I'm fortunate that I have not been physically assaulted while at work, though I know people who have. My latest memory is of a physician who was hit in the face while interviewing a client in the emergency department. This physician did everything correctly. He had a security officer outside the door. The physician was next to the door, leaning out of the room. He had a stretcher between the client and himself. But in the blink of an eye, the client was able to jump across the stretcher, strike the physician, knock him to the ground, all before a security officer was able to stop the client. I have a friend, Jack, who was a security officer at the emergency department that I work. In the process of restraining a violent client, which is almost a daily event where I work, this client had concealed a weapon and was able to cut Jack in his hand, and subsequently he was off work for quite some time, had to have extensive surgery to his hand, and he no longer works in our department. I don't know if he doesn't work in our department because of that assault or not, but if it is because of that assault, I don't really blame him. Jack, who's a very large man, formidable, he's one of the more compassionate people that I used to work with. He's as compassionate as any nurse, and he's a loss to my department. There was a man who we had to restrain because he was a threat to himself, and he decided that he was going to leave our department. We couldn't allow that. It took several staff members to help restrain this client. We were fortunate that a police officer was there, and the police officer came in to help with the restraint. During the event, the client's hand, while being restrained, came close to the officer's weapon, and the nurse at the head of the bed noticed this and cried out that this was going on, and the client was going for the weapon, and they were able to stop that individual. But if the individual had gotten the officer's weapon, things could have been much different. Often nurses at the triage desk, where often people first come into the emergency department, nurses there can be threatened on a regular basis with physical harm, either due to violent clients coming in or people being unhappy with the services that they receive. At my particular facility, we have 10-inch long pagers that we hand to clients if they have to wait, and it's a great communication tool where when a room's available, we can page them. They can know that they can come up to the desk. And these have now been turned into weapons where if someone is unhappy with the wait time or the services, they are now being thrown at the nurses at the front desk. I'd also like to note at this point that each one of these events happen in rooms where other clients are in rooms next door or across from. If you go to an emergency department for whatever issue, you know, there's a chance that a violent event can happen, you know, within 10 feet of you. You may or may not know it, but it's there, and it's daily. I experience more violence in my workplace than I do in any part of my life, and I live in a big city. Clients with a history of violence towards staff are allowed to come back to the department after verbal and physical infractions against staff, sometimes the same day. My employer states that we cannot turn these people away. I don't know if this is true. Inform the client that they are no longer allowed at the facility because of their violent behavior leaves employers open to criticism. And I found employers don't like to be criticized, especially when clients can choose to go to another health facility. And we're at a time where I work where public relations in the community is a high priority, and some nurses are feeling that they are being allowed to be abused by clients as long as no one hears about it. Depending on the manager, there are varying levels of support for staff members who have been a victim of violence. I personally have a manager who is very supportive and encourages reporting to our facility and the law enforcement. I do not believe that this is true with all managers or with all facilities. There are some managers who still hold to the culture that you know the risk when you come to work and you just have to learn how to deal with it. While higher administration does not officially prevent the reporting of incidents of violence to law enforcement, it may not be encouraged. Something that sets health workers apart from other occupations is that a healthcare worker has to get physically close to someone they just met. My other job probably would have been a florist. People ask me at work, they're like, "Well, if you weren't a nurse, what would you do?" And I was like, "I don't know, I'd be a florist." You know? And but with a florist, I have a desk across from somebody. Odds are they're not going to be mad. I mean, they're not going to be mad at me. I might not be giving them flowers. But as a healthcare, you know, but as a healthcare provider, sometimes we have to say things you don't want to hear. Sometimes we have to do things that you don't really want us to do. And in the process of providing care, we have to let our guard down. You know, we're compassionate people. As a nurse, I'm required to get within inches of a stranger, drop my defenses, and pretty much trust that you're not going to strike me. I do this knowingly. I go into work. It's my job, and I like it. You do these things because that's part of the quality of care that you expect from us. For me to help you and your loved ones, whatever's happened, I have to trust in you. Another thing that sets nurses apart from other occupations is that I have a duty to care. I'm not allowed not to care for you. If you come in and you're part of my assignment, regardless of your history, whether you smell bad, whether you're cursing at me, I still have a responsibility. And while I've had training and there are safeguards in place to help protect me, it really didn't do that physician a whole lot of good when he got slammed to the ground. So I'm a nurse. I work in an emergency department. I'm there 3 days a week, sometimes a little more. And I'm going to be there, and I'll be there when the ice moves in, or one or two times a year, and the roads are all messed up and people are crashing into each other. I'm the one person that's going to go into work that day. And if I don't think I can go home that night, I'll spend the night, and I'll be there the next day to make sure that that front door is open for you. Nurses are there for you, and we want you there. We're there for you, and we will be there for you. And so I guess now's the time where we're kind of asking you to be there for us. And I think that ends my comment.
Thank you, Mr. Clement.
Thank you.
Any questions of the witnesses?
Yes, Madam Chair. Question?
Yes.
And this is probably directed to Brian. And, Brian, if you don't know the answer, that's fine. And it's regarding JCO standards, Joint Commission for Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, and how those standards marry up with this proposed bill. Can, any comments on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, first response is when I don't know. I will tell you I don't know. I've been here a long time, and I don't want to lead anybody on. And quite frankly, I don't know fully in this particular case as far as JCO standards. The one response I can tell you, of course, is that JCO is totally voluntary. So you have facilities that may not, in fact, follow any JCO standards that would be out there. But I can find out that information, and I'll get back to you on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to us.
You bet. Thank you for coming. We're going to be ending at 10 today because two of the members have another meeting to go to. Actually, if people have come from a ways, we will allow testimony, but I just want you to know that two of our members will be leaving at 10. Rob Wagner and Dan Dover.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, I'm Rob Wagner. I'm the Political and Legislative Affairs Director for the American Federation of Teachers here in Oregon. We're 11,000 members. 3,000 of our members are nurses and other health professionals with the Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals, which are in the Kaiser system, and then also Providence, Milwaukee, in the illustrious House District 41. We also represent nurse educators at community colleges. I'll keep my testimony exceedingly brief. We're very supportive of the legislation and really appreciate the work that the Interim Task Force did to bring this bill forward this session. Also very appreciative of the Oregon Nurses Association, the efforts that they made during the last legislative session. With me today is Dan Dover, who's been a registered nurse for over 26 years, just to share his perspective firsthand of the importance of this important piece of legislation. I apologize for my voice.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, as he said, my name is Dan Dover. I've been involved in bedside care for over 30 years. I started out in respiratory therapy. While I was in nursing school, I worked as a nurse aide in an intensive care unit. I have worked the last 26 years as an RN, almost exclusively in ICU. I have worked some in a state psychiatric hospital, so I was very glad to hear mention of this bill applying to the state hospital. For those who don't know, state hospitals are very unstable places where physical confrontations are frequent. When I first went to work in a state hospital, I had never been a person who used my physical presence to enforce my will on anyone, and I found on a regular basis people using physical presence to enforce their will on me. Despite that, despite being in an environment where physical confrontation is the norm, I had no training. I had my nursing school training. My nursing school training for psychosocial talked to me about how to deal with an elderly patient who thinks there's a tiger under the bed. Really didn't apply. Working at that hospital, I had more physical confrontations than I've ever had in my life. I had an episode where a young man had petitioned to be taken off his medications so he could have a new hearing to be released. He was a very unstable gentleman. The night before I came to work, he had injured three people. They had put him strapped him down to a bed. When I got there that morning, the aide had let him out. That aide went to lunch, left a very small person there, one person in a giant ward. When I went, he called me saying things had gone bad. I went there. This gentleman, in the process of this incident, got a hold of a board with nails sticking out of the end of it and a pen that he tried to use as a knife and attacked myself and the other person. The other person essentially just fainted. In the process of trying to save my own life, I lost control, and I overreacted because I did not know what to do. But I was extremely scared, and I had been hit in the head several times. I could have caused this person real serious damage because of not having the training in how to deal with this incident. Luckily, some of the patients went and hit the panic button and got more people over there. It's just one example. I've been being a male and a fairly substantial male in an inpatient facility, whenever there's what we call code strongs, I was there. I have a reputation of being able to talk people down that can be talked down, but also for being there and being able to help deal with people that can't be talked down. I have been an instructor for nonviolent intervention at Kaiser Sunnyside. Did that for about 5 years. At the moment, I work in the National Kaiser Office in Oakland, although I live here, in the development of the electronic medical record. My wife is a respiratory therapist. I think that the fact that this bill applies to all medical workers is extremely important. One thing I did notice there is mentioned ambulatory surgical centers and hospitals. Didn't say anything about ambulatory clinics. Clinics are also very dangerous places at times. Many people come to clinics exhibiting drug-seeking behavior that often results in violence. I don't believe that the level of violence that we find in today's hospitals and clinics is very well documented. Many of the incidents that I've been in a thing where an elderly man in an ICU who was just suffering from ICU psychosis had a pair of scissors in his bag and managed to get them out and tried to attack us with those scissors. It wasn't documented. We got him down. We took the scissors away from him. We gave him some medication. We tried to reassure him. But it was never documented. Lots of our instances are not documented. And that concerns me a great deal. Because if we have a problem and we don't have statistics, we don't know what the problem is. So the fact that this bill requires that, it requires reporting, requires overview, makes me want to support it in a very strong way. Like I said, I'm here, my family's here, mostly my entire social structure are other healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists, nurse aides, people who deserve all the protection we can give them because of the wonderful and important work that they're doing. And I just want to commend everybody who helped structure this bill, and I want to encourage you in the name of the people who are out there on the front lines taking care of your family members and our family members and trying to make this world as good a place as we can to give us that little extra edge of protection. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
I have a question for you and Representative Olson.
Yes.
As a rookie and not being part of the task force, I don't want to go deeply into this, but I'm curious, in your task force work, are Oregon's nurse trainers, the OHS school, Linfield, and so forth, were they involved in the... And did they come to the table, and what did they say about training in this area?
Is I'm going to hold off just a minute. Is this something that we should say for a work session, or something we should do?
If there's going to be substantial testimony, you should go back up to the stand.
Okay. We need to ask Representative Olson to go back to the stand if this is going to be substantial.
No, I tell you, let's do that in a break. It just occurred to me, and it's probably the wrong time to ask.
That's just fine. We're all learning, believe
okay.
me. Thank you. Okay, Joe Thurman, and let's call up at the same time Claudia Black and Janelle somebody. Is there a Janelle? It's
Jane Ellen. I'm sorry, my handwriting.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, to answer the question that was just proposed to Representative Olson, I was on that task force. My name is Joe Thurman. I'm a registered nurse at Oregon State Hospital. I'm also the president of AFSCME Local 3295, along with being a professional assault response trainer, PROACT, where we do teach our staff how to use verbal communications as well as physical, if necessary, to do an intervention. I'm here today to support the bill. I think that it's long overdue, and it's really important to ensure that our health care providers stay as safe as possible to ensure they can give the best care. As you're probably aware, the incidence of assault in the United States have gone up drastically over the last 10 years probably, as evidenced by all your dental offices and clinics are now putting in glass shields where they used to not have. They used to have open bubbles. Now they don't. And so I commend you for the work you've done on this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Claudia?
Hi, for the record, my name is Claudia Black, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Medical Association. And first of all, I want to say that I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this very important bill, and I'll keep my comments brief. We do have some concerns about the impact of the proposed legislation on ambulatory surgical centers, and while we don't want to hold up the bill at this time, we would like to work with the bill proponents to determine the best way to address our concerns on the Senate side. And I thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to address any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you, Claudia. Jane Ellen, and how do you spell your last name, Jane Ellen?
It's WEIDANZ.
Thank you.
And I do apologize for my handwriting. My third grade teacher would be appalled. My name is Jane Ellen Whiteance, and I now represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I'm here today with significant concerns about the bill. And they're actually very similar to the concerns of the bill that I had in my former role of working with seniors and people with disabilities throughout the state. I want to thank Representative Olson for all of his work in the task force and all the members of the task force during the interim to reach a compromise. But I think that there is still just fundamentally one piece of the bill that just kind of, as an advocate for seniors and people with disabilities and for people with mental illness across the state, I continue to have grave concerns, and that's Section 7 of the bill. And if you look at Section 7 of the bill, it basically allows healthcare employees to assert that they were acting in self-defense if they physically assault a resident or a client or a patient of a healthcare facility. And as back in January, in front of the interim task force, Orsha said that many of the people that are causing these, the physical abuse, are actually people who don't intentionally want to hurt healthcare employees. What they're doing is they're acting out of psychosis, like we heard in the previous testimony. They're acting out of fear. They're not physically capable any longer of controlling their physical actions, such as people with advanced Huntington's disease or Alzheimer's. These people are often 94% of the cases are caused by accident. And then allowing healthcare staff to then retaliate in kind just to me sets up a dangerous precedent. And I would like urge that we continue to work on that piece of the legislation to try to come up with a way to protect healthcare workers, to work together as both employers and employees and patients to address the issue of workplace violence, because we think it's critical that we do have a safe place for both our residents, our patients, and our employees to be there. But this piece is still is a grave concern to us. Thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you. Any questions of any of the witnesses? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can someone give me a little more background on the statistics that OSHA has and how they're collected?
Chair Tomei and Representative Kotek, I'll do my best to answer. I was reading actually the testimony that OSHA delivered in January of 2006 before the interim task force, and not to speak for another organization, but it seemed like from their testimony that they actually don't break it down very far, that the information is still very broad and it's very hard for them to give specific information. And the statistics that they cited in that testimony, and I could provide copies of it because we still have copies, the information that they were able to deliver also pulled from national data and national studies.
Madam, I know that OSHA does require...
Could you give us your name again?
Oh, Joe Thurman.
Thank you.
I'm a registered nurse at the state hospital.
Thank you.
I know that OSHA does require that, I believe it's called OSHA 300 log, or maybe it's a 500 log, which does go through at the state hospital anyway, and describe the incident and what happened during the incident. And so there is a documentation, and the hospital has been very good about writing down and keeping a log of how many incidences have happened. I'm aware that other places may not be as good about it, but
Thank you. Yeah, I was wondering if it's particular institutions or all of the, I mean.
I think so.
It seems that we're lacking the data, so to have that kind of number, I'm just curious what it covers. So,
and I'm also on the safety committee, and I've gone down to labor and industries and asked for specific data, and it's very hard to get.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is for Mr. Thurman, and specifically your comment about the glass shields. In my clinic, we installed glass shields, not for violence in the workplace, but because of HIPAA. And so it was really associated with a privacy issue as opposed to a violence in the workplace. My other question, and it's really, I guess, a comment about how this bill begins to protect people and facilities and liability issues and the whole issue of tort, and how that, if this bill, in your opinion, has any influence in that area, so facilities are not arbitrarily sued, people are not arbitrarily sued in the performance of their duties. Any comments?
I, at the state hospital level, as you're probably aware, we probably get sued a lot down there. But as far as liability issues, I think that is probably a training issue, and being able to document what training staff have been through and ensure they have good crisis communications training.
Joe, could you identify that you were the last speaker, please?
Oh, Joe, my name is Joe Thurman.
Thank you. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question regarding your concerns about Section 7. I understand the concerns that you're voicing, and I'm just curious if you have any recommendations as to what would what potential changes might alleviate those concerns.
Chair Tomei and Representative Cowan, this has been, since the Senate bill was introduced last session, this has been something that has just continuously scared me. I mean, it really does scare me, because I think it's a slippery slope. I have worked with people with developmental disabilities that have accidentally slapped out at me because of a cerebral palsy or some other accident. I've worked with seniors who have accidentally scratched me, and this bill actually includes things like scratching. So I have not figured out a way to amend this piece where it would protect the patients, which is my greatest concern, and protect on the liability issue as well as protect the facility. And I just think that lots of brains need to get together to continue to work on this piece of legislation and on that section specifically.
Representative Maurer, did you have another question?
Ma'am, I have lots of questions, but I won't ask them all today.
All right, great. This will not be our only hearing, so. Yes,
thank you. Thank you. And this might not be the right group to answer the question, but I would like to know what some of the discussions were around the Section 7 issues. It's my understanding that there's been an attempt to come up with some solution, and it might not be perfect. You know, we have to balance the safety of the worker, the safety of other patients, as well as the actual patient who's having the violent incident. So I'm assuming that got discussed in some depth in the interim. And maybe that's just providing additional information for our next conversation. So thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Mayor.
If this is going to be testimony, I probably will need to
ask a question.
Okay.
Thank you for allowing me to ask a
question.
How do you see retaliatory efforts involved in chapter or in Section 7? That's what I'm curious about, because there was at length about that, and that was designed actually to prevent that.
Chairwoman Tomei and Representative Olson,
could you identify yourself?
Jane Ellen Whitehands with the Oregon Hospital Association, and thank you. I should let you know that I'm pretty new to this position, left the Department of Human Services on November 30th and started working for the Hospital Association on December 1st. So I'm still backtracking a little bit on information and work that happened during the interim for the association. Where I think that the concern for me is that the staff people are often the people in power. When you go into a healthcare facility, you give up a lot of power. And you give up power because you're in crisis. If you're going into a long-term care facility, you're going there because you can no longer meet your own needs. If you're going into a hospital, it's usually because something as critical has happened to you. And so you have given up a lot of your personal control. And the people that, even if it's not true in the eyes of the staff, it's the staff that have the power in the situation. And so I think that it's that there's already an unbalanced situation where healthcare staff and employers have the power in the situation in direct relationship to the patient, and the patient often feels powerless. I remember my grandmother when she had to have heart surgery and went into the hospital, and I was fairly, let's say, assertive in protecting her rights and her needs and being what I thought is a good granddaughter. And she'd reach over to me and she says, "Shush, honey, you're going to cause problems." And I'm like, "Well, that's my job. I'm your granddaughter." And she's like, no, I don't want them to be mean to me." And I think that that's where you have a power situation and an unbalance. And so it's almost like some of the situations in Department of Corrections or with police, et cetera, where you always have to balance and help rebalance and give power to the patient. And that's where I see that by saying that the staff person gets to say that the issue was in acting in self-defense, that's where the piece really concerns me, is it's the staff person asserting that they've acted in self-defense that then means that there's no disciplinary action that the facility can take.
Thank you.
I follow up. Section 7, since you're referring to that, subsection C. Or at least let's go down to subsection 2. As used in the let me back up. Excuse me. Since you're referring to that again, sub C says used the least restrictive procedures necessary under the circumstances in accordance with an approved behavior management plan. If you further read that, you'll understand that management has provided the training in accordance with that operation. To the point that if you have a healthcare employee that exceeds their abuse or exceeds their authority, that would be recognized by management, and they can take care of that through a criminal procedure, just as it would be the same for law enforcement. There's no difference. So if a police officer were to step forward and retaliate, that in itself would be a criminal act. It applies the same in the situation you're trying to describe.
And can I just say something on that?
Could you identify yourself?
My name is Joe Thurman, and I'm a registered nurse at Oregon State Hospital. One of the things that a person is always, if there's any question whatsoever, is to go to OIT and cause an investigation to be started. And at that point, it's got to stop or they'd be prosecuted. I think it's a training issue. I think they need to be trained up front.
Thank you, Joe. Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In relation to the state hospital, how specific are the behavior plans? And would a potential solution be to tie that process of determining whether something was self-defense to a behavior plan that outlined behaviors that a patient was likely to have with likely interventions for de-escalation of that behavior? And was there any discussion about language that would allow discipline when the staff person was deviating from that behavior plan, even during a violent outburst from an individual that had been identified on that behavior plan?
Chair Tomei and Representative Gelser, I'm not here representing the Oregon Hospital, State Hospital. Jane Ellen Wyden.
Thank you.
So I'm leery to say how detailed their behavior management plans are. And back to Representative Olson's comments, I would need to double check and see specifically how detailed the behavior management plans are also in hospitals, and we'll get back to you on that very quickly.
Follow. Were there specific discussions during the course of the task force regarding individuals with developmental disabilities that might come into a hospital setting where there would not be a behavior plan in place because perhaps that person was not known to the hospital and maybe their behaviors wouldn't be recognized, and also what might not be recognized are the actions that might trigger escalations of behavior violent outbursts?
Chair Tomei and Representative Gelser, again, since I came to the Oregon Association of Hospitals after the task force completed its work, I'm leery to say of what they actually spoke about at that point. But that's one of the concerns that I have, again, is that you have people coming in who already have a set disposition or a set condition that may cause them to act out, especially in new environments, and how do you then address their issues if you don't have a behavior management plan.
Madam Chair, would it be possible for us to get some more of that information about this specific issue during those discussions, specifically related to people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, and other conditions that might be known to trigger violence?
Yes,
we can do that. Behaviors. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Madam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is to Jane Owen. Ms. Wydance, has the association taken any kind of inventory of what hospitals are currently doing? Because the assertion that, you know, they're interested in protecting the workers and preventing workplace violence, this has been in the works for a while. Is there a summary of what hospitals are currently doing that we could that you could provide to the committee so we can get a sense of that?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, we will get you that survey and that the information on what hospitals are currently doing.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I think our last, if we have anybody else who's interested in testifying after Sarah Myers, is there anyone else who has not signed up but is interested in speaking? All right, Sarah.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Myers. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Association for Home Care. We represent more than 60 certified, Medicare-certified home health, hospice, and in-home care agencies here in the state of Oregon. I wanted just to briefly address some of the issues that have been brought up by Representative Maurer and Representative Kotek with respect to the Joint Commission accreditation. There are patient safety standards that most, if not all, home health agencies with respect to that accreditation are required to meet. And in addition to that, they do have specific patient safety standard training for orientation for nurses, therapists, and home health aides that are to deliver direct care to patients in their homes. In addition, during the interim and prior to that time, we did collect information from OSHA regarding incidences related specifically to home health care, of which there were zero. And we were able to ascertain from that in addition to knowing that there were no documented cases by OSHA specifically related to home health care incidences in the patient's home, that they were more geared toward other settings, such as in-home care, maybe personally related to services provided by the state of Oregon through a client-employed provider situation, perhaps, or perhaps another other type of setting, such as nursing homes, assisted living facilities, or residential care facilities, for which this bill does not address. In addition to that, I wanted to address the definition in the bill that does talk specifically about a health care employer, and then also there relates to home health services, and to point out that this bill does bifurcate the industry of home care by simply making that definition, as I read it, applicable only to home health agencies that are affiliated with a facility. During our testimony to the Senate and the House during the prior legislative session, we did point that out, and we also did point that out during the interim during the task force. Again, so basically what my understanding and my reading of that definition and that we have contested it, that number one, there is no documented reason for which home health should be included. It was simply that we believe that the reason for which we are being included in this is because we do have facilities that are operated and owned by hospital facilities, and we believe that this is a nursing, Oregon Nurses Association attempt to, because there are issues that they are unable to address through the regulations with the hospitals, that we are being kind of swept in by this. Again, we are concerned that there are other services that are not being included. Not that we would recommend that there is a need for that, but certainly that this bill seems to be very selective about the types and facility types of services that are being addressed. One of the other issues that has come up for our home health agencies, specifically in rural areas, is the requirement to carry technology devices so that when delivering care in the home, they are able to contact either the main agency or someone else to call for assistance. And as you may know, in very rural areas of Oregon where care is being delivered, cell phone service is non-existent. So this would place a requirement on some agencies to provide satellite phones to all of their caregivers at the cost of a more than $1,000 per device plus the cost of service. So not to say that we certainly do not support the aspects of this bill that talk about security and safety and protection, for which we make sure that all of our trained individuals entering the home do have access to that training and understanding, and that if there is ever any question as to the concept of danger of delivering patient services to that patient, those caregivers are able to say this is not a safe situation. And in more cases often than not, the employer is going to support that. And number one, they will either not recommend this patient being a viable patient for services to receive services in the home, or they will discharge the patient, which is fully within their capability to do so. Whereas in a hospital setting, regardless of the patient's mental status or physical status or threat to caregivers, they're not able to do that. But in a home health setting, we are able, and we do have that choice. And as I said, specifically because we do support the protection of our caregivers in a situation where in this state and in many states there is a shortage of nurses and therapists, why would we ever send one of those caregivers into a home where there is a threat to their physical well-being? I think I'll just conclude my comments there, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have. We've, as I said, been very supportive of the fact that we want to ensure that there is safety for our caregivers delivering services in the home. We do not want to curtail access to these patients, and I am afraid that by adding on additional cost providing these services to home health agencies and only a select number of home health agencies in the state, we may be adding on access issues to patient care, forcing them into other settings such as nursing home care, whereas this bill does not cover those situations or those settings. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sarah. Any questions of the witness?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Again, it's the same question I had to the Hospital Association. If I would be interested in knowing what your agencies do to make sure that the situation is safe, assessing the patient, you know, is training, you know, once when they come on board, is it ongoing training? Some backup on that would be helpful for us. Thank you.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, during the initial review of the bill, during the 2005 legislative session, we did provide a voluminous amount of patient safety standards and trainings programs to the committees reviewing the bill, so that there was a broad array of demonstration of the different types of programs that each of the agencies do employ by assisting their caregivers in knowing what to do in specific situations. Again, when we receive a referral for a patient from a physician, we know quite a bit about that patient, and we can determine even before one of our caregivers is even sent to that home whether or not they're appropriate to receive services. If they have a significant mental or psychological disorder, we may decide before we even send a caregiver to that patient's home that it's not appropriate, it's not a safe setting. And if we're not able to determine that generally from the information we receive on the referral, from the first visit when the nurse goes out to assess the patient's needs, it can be determined at that time whether or not the patient, again, is an appropriate patient. But one of the nurses that testified previously did bring up some other issues, and that is danger from non-patients. how do we regulate that, or how do we control that? And I would testify here that I don't think we can. You cannot regulate every situation that someone may encounter. But in the situation that she testified in regard to, I can certainly say that a nurse that went back to one of our agencies who reported that there was a non-patient in the home drinking with a gun is not a safe situation to deliver care. And I would hope that the agency would dismiss that patient from care, and you know, unfortunately, but it's not a safe situation for that nurse to be delivering care when her safety is at risk.
I just have concerns about the idea of dismissing the patient. I understand that that's an option, but you know, if we're trying to provide the most effective, efficient care, that sometimes means in the home. So the flip side of that is making it as safe as possible for the nurse who's trying to discharge their duty in the home. So, I don't know if that's an acceptable fallback to just discharge the patient.
And Chair, today, Representative Kotek, I appreciate that position, and I understand that. But where we can't necessarily as caregivers, you know, as our caregivers can do anything about that situation, we can't force the removal of a non-patient to deliver the care to that patient. I don't see that asking a second person to come into that home would have made that any safer of a situation for either person, you know, where the non-patient is drinking and has a revolver. I think that's adding two people to a situation that is a non-safe situation. And again, and adding a cell phone to that, I think also is a very minor Band-Aid. And so in the most appropriate situation of that, you know, if it cannot be resolved either through general legal means by reporting the situation to the local law enforcement and having them address that issue or situation so that perhaps maybe that person's not there when care is being delivered, that may be an option. But we certainly, our agencies want to make sure we're supportive of those caregivers and make sure that they are safe and healthy and able to continue to deliver care to patients, as you say, in the most effective and efficient manner, which is what our main goal is.
Sarah, you've mentioned some voluminous material that you had given to the previous committee. Maybe you can provide some of that to this committee since we'll be having other hearings on this. I'm going to rush us along, and I know we have one more question from Representative Gelser, and then I'm going to have Patty O'Sullivan speak, and then, Brian, I'm going to ask you to come up one last time.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. What policies and procedures do the home health care agencies currently have in place to protect their workers on that initial visit to the home when the circumstances of the family caregivers are not known?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, I think specifically to the initial visit, it's not specific to that per se, versus the general training that they might receive either through classes, video trainings, again, just various different methods by which they know in certain circumstances what they should be doing or whether or not they should even enter the home or if they are in the home and a situation arises that they should immediately leave. So I don't believe it's specific necessarily, and it does vary agency to agency, but the fact that most are Joint Commission accredited and that there are patient and safety standard goals that are required for that accreditation, each has a program in place by which either during orientation and or annually they undergo training so that they understand what to do in a given situation.
I do a follow-up. So is it common practice right now in extreme rural areas where there is not easy access to emergency personnel and there is no cell phone coverage, is it common that individual health care providers will be going into strangers' homes without anyone else there to back them up? Is that the regular practice?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, yes, I would imagine it is because many agencies in rural Oregon have one nurse or one home health aide on their staff. I can think of, for example, Asher Home Health in Fossil, Oregon, very rural. And so to deliver care to a patient in their home who may be 50, 60 miles from the closest hospital, and that this being the most efficient way to treat the patient following an incident from a medical incident, that yes, in fact, there may only be one nurse. And that agency may not have an option to involve an additional patient, additional person to attend that visit with them.
Thank you.
Looks like we have a lot more work to do on this bill. Patty O'Sullivan?
Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. I mean, Sarah.
Good morning. My name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Government Relations for the Department of Human Services, and I'll be very brief. I didn't intend to testify this morning, but since we had an employee and an ex-employee testifying, I thought you'd want to hear a formal position of the department on the bill. I've worked with Representative Olson a little bit to get a very brief amendment to make sure that the definitions are very clear, that it does not include our home care workers that go into homes and actually work for our clients. He agreed it wasn't intended to and agreed to the amendment. With that amendment, we would be in support of the bill. I'd like to address very quickly a couple things that were said. Section 7, our folks looked at very carefully, and with collective bargaining agreements, with rules, with procedures, with training that have already occurred and we already have, we can live with Section 7 in the state hospital and other facilities. For Representative Gelser, I'd be glad to have Bob come and talk about what happens in the community with the mentally ill and developmentally disabled. But I will say that when we were doing the site selection criteria for the state hospital last summer, we did address the fact that in a community where we would put one of these facilities, the local hospital has to be in sync with us because we do take our clients there when they have a physical problem and, you know, they are mentally ill. So, for instance, we talked a lot about how Salem Hospital is so good about that because they're so used to it. As for others out in the community and just any old hospital, I can't answer that, but Bob might be able to. So if you'd like some follow-up with that, I'd be glad to have that happen.
Thank you.
Okay, great. And with that, I will conclude my testimony.
Any questions of Mrs. Sullivan? Okay, thank you.
Brian? Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes, Brian DeLashmet. You heard Representative Gelser's question several minutes ago. And can you provide us information on the questions that she was raising?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, as you may or may not be aware, I also represent group homes for DD clients. So I have an interest in making sure that their health and safety is very much protected. As we went through not only the original Bill 572, but the interim, that specific issue around the level of self-defense has evolved into what you see before you from a much more just open statement of that an employer can't discipline somebody for an act of self-defense. So with specific standards put in this bill, as Representative Olson pointed out, when you talk about the plan itself, that was specifically put in there by some advocates for the DD population. So make it very clear, and obviously I have the same concerns you have about, the ability to declare self-defense for somebody who really is the aggressor, but we don't believe that with these safeguards in there, when you're following the plan and it's the employer that in conjunction with the employees that sets up that plan for what the appropriate level is, it would be a very unusual situation, I think, in which you're going to find a violation of that causes concern. What we were specifically concerned about is in a number of mental health settings, including during last session, a whole volume of nurses came over from the psych unit at Salem Hospital here, not State Hospital, although the State Hospital people did come too. They said they have a number of clients that on a regular basis will beat up staff and say, I got Mary on Friday. Your turn is this next Friday. They have the cognitive ability to know exactly what they're doing. So we're not talking about the populations that I think were thrown out on the table here as the prime example of potential abuse. We're talking about somebody that has the cognitive ability to take an action, know what they're doing, and whether or not that staff person has an ability to respond and defend themselves.
Brian, I'm going to stop you because the time is running out and these people need to get to another very important hearing. But what I'm asking is, it sounds like you have a lot of written information that, that can be passed on to the committee, and that would respond to some of the questions that have been asked today. If you could pass that along. And if people have any other requests to make of Brian, please let it be known now. Representative Gelser?
Could I just say thank you for providing that information? That is extremely helpful to me. Thank you.
Great. Any other requests of Mr. DeLashmet before we conclude? And as I said before, we will have other hearings on this matter. It's a very important bill, and we want to make sure that it passes. But we want to make sure that it's a good bill and that it will pass the Senate also. So if you have any other concerns and questions, please pass them on to Representative Olson and myself, and we'll try to get as much information as you need so that you're going to feel happy about this bill. Thank you very much, Brian. Thanks to all the people who testified today and who have interest in this bill. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2022. And unless people have any questions or concerns, I'm going to close. Yes.
What do you expect the next step on this one is, or do we know?
I think that, that there will be more conversation with folks who want to pass this bill and people who have concerns about the bill. There will be concerns outside of this hearing room, and then we'll deal with it further in another public hearing. Any other questions or concerns? Thank you very much. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.